We're talking about the work of the State Hygiene Lab. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. This lab tests thousands of blood samples each year for drunken driving and drug driving cases, and its specimen caseload is growing. What questions do you have about the State Hygiene Lab? What do you want to know about what cases are tested and the work of forensic toxicology? Join in at 800-642-1234. Amy Miles is the director of forensic toxicology at the Wisconsin State Laboratory of Hygiene, and that's where she's worked for 20 years. Amy, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Good morning.
Well, the State Crime Lab received a whole bunch of attention last year with the headlines about evidence backlogs and the attorney general election, but the State Hygiene Lab is a whole different operation. Can you tell us about the focus of each lab and how it's different?
Sure. So for the crime lab, they really do more of the felony work. And like you mentioned, there is a forensic toxicology component to them, but then they are much broader than that for the forensic science. So they'll do other forensic science disciplines like DNA. That tends to be the one we hear about the most. And we do overlap with the forensic toxicology piece, and we do collaborate. So we make sure that we're both sort of doing the same type of testing and providing the same services across the state. Where we diverge, though, is the State Lab of Hygiene is within the University of Wisconsin School of Medicine and Public Health. And the State Lab of Hygiene has actually been in existence since about 1903.
And long time.
Very long time, right around when I was born. So within the State Lab of Hygiene, though, you know, as we talked about, there's a forensic toxicology component, but we do have a lot more than that because we are the public health lab for the state. So some of the other pieces that we have are infectious disease, genetics, cancer screening. A lot of people know about newborn screening. Mm-hmm. That's a big piece of what we do. We also do air quality, water quality, soil testing, fish testing. Occupational and worker health is also a big piece of the State Lab of Hygiene. And then, of course, the forensic toxicology component. And then I can never not give a shout out to our information systems group. Because we're such a large laboratory and do so much testing, a lot of what we produce is data for our partners. And so through partnerships with people like the Department of Health, the DNR, the Department of Transportation, we provide data to a lot of different entities and agencies so that they can kind of make policy and procedure decisions as well.
So as being part of the UW system, you know, Wisconsin's Attorney General oversees the State Crime Lab. Who oversees the Hygiene Lab?
So as I mentioned, we're part of the UW School of Medicine and Public Health. However, we do sort of sit in an entity of itself. And so our director of the State Lab of Hygiene, my boss is Dr. Jamie Schauer, and his background is really that environmental science piece. And so a lot of what the State Lab of Hygiene does ties in well with the university and research. And then the forensic toxicology also does a lot of that research piece. But as you mentioned, we do a lot of law enforcement work, and then we also do death investigation work as well. So we do tie in with that public health piece because we do provide information to our partners.
We're learning about the State Hygiene Lab and what it does with Amy Miles. She is the lab's director of forensic toxicology. What questions do you have about the State Hygiene Lab? What do you want to know about testing for drunk and drugged driving cases? What questions do you have about forensic toxicology in general? Do you watch crime shows like CSI or Law & Order? What do you want to know about this work? We're at 800-642-1234. For email ideas at WPR.org. Amy, let's go into your lab for a moment and give us a feel for what the average day of one of your lab workers is like. What goes on there? Paint a picture.
Well, we have a pretty phenomenal crew. I'm really proud of the people that I get to work with every day. A lot of what we do not only entails work in Wisconsin, but we do a lot of work with partners across the country. So I've seen a lot of different laboratories and what they do in reference to what we do. And by far, that sample load that you talked about of about 24,000 cases, we are the busiest lab in the country for what we do in a public sector. So an average day for any of our toxicologists really varies. You can have a day in the lab where you're just working on samples, or you can have a day in court where you have to drive from Madison to Superior and then come back and then do lab work the next day or be in court the next day. We do a lot of outreach and training and education because as being part of the university, we find that that's a huge part of our mission. And what we should be doing for the citizens of Wisconsin is not only providing that testing, but then educating and reminding and outreach about drugs, alcohol, and human performance.
You also train law enforcement and prosecutors on the effects of drug and alcohol on driving. What are the key things you need to convey when you train in your training?
A lot of the time when we're talking to any of those groups, we try to convey just the data that we produce, so how many cases we do, what types of cases we see. But then also when we talk to law enforcement, we try to stress to them to try to assess the individual and don't base their opinion of impairment just on those field sobriety tests that they do, but we want them to expand that beyond to look at other indicators of impairment.
Hmm. Wisconsin is the only state that doesn't criminalize drunk driving on the first offense, and some lawmakers want to make the first offense a misdemeanor. If that happened, what would be the impact on the hygiene lab's operations?
You know, with the volume that we do and with the average blood alcohol concentration that we see, which is right around a 0.15 to a 0.17 for the state, I really don't know, and I don't think it will make that much of a difference. Most of the cases we see are greater than a 0.08. And I don't know that changing the severity of that first offense will really change our operations in the lab. It may change the way law enforcement look at the arrests, but most of the people they're seeing that are operating while intoxicated are well above that 0.08 threshold.
How often is the hygiene lab testing evidence for death investigations or cases involving fatalities?
So the motor vehicle death that we do probably about 400 of those cases a year. And then of the medical examiner cases, we probably do about 2,500 of those a year. And what's a little unique about our laboratory is we do both of those. A lot of laboratories either focus on the impaired driving piece or they are solely a medical examiner laboratory. So for us, we kind of are a one-stop shop for all of that testing.
Kind of a clearinghouse then. So are drugs or alcohol often a factor then in fatal traffic crashes? What does your data show?
Yeah, so in looking at our data over the last few years, I would say about 30 to 40% of those cases have alcohol on board. And then the second most common drug we see is marijuana. So roughly 13 to 16% of those motor vehicle death cases also have marijuana on board. And then it drops pretty quickly after that to different types of drugs. But alcohol and marijuana definitely are the most common that we see in motor vehicle deaths and then just in our impaired driving population.
What can we deduce about the effects of marijuana on drivers? What do we know there?
Well, that's actually a good question that a lot of scientists have been trying to answer for decades. And the answer we come up with is we know there's impairing effects. We know it's different from person to person. And we absolutely know that we can't really pinpoint or measure it for each individual. So the greatest take-home message is if you're going to consume marijuana and then you think you should drive, stop and think about it. Mm-hmm. Because most people don't realize their judgment or their reaction time is affected even though they may not realize it.
Talking with Amy Miles, Director of Forensic Toxicology Section at the lab, the State Hygiene Lab. You can join in 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about forensic toxicology? Do you watch crime shows like CSI? What do you want to know about this work in real life? How do you think the state lab should respond to the growing caseload? Call in. You can also tweet us at WPR Mornings. We'll get back to this in just a moment here on the Ideas Network. We're talking about the work of the State Hygiene Lab. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The forensic toxicology section of this state lab receives more than 20,000 specimens a year for alcohol and or drug testing. The hygiene lab tests blood and urine, other biological samples for operating well under the influence cases, and the caseload is growing. Join in with your questions, 800-642-1234. So how do you think the state should respond to the hygiene lab's growing caseload? Should lawmakers add workers or more funding for equipment? Should the lab just work with its existing resources? Call in. You can also tweet us at WPR Mornings. Amy Miles is director of forensic toxicology at the State Hygiene Lab, and she stays with us. Amy, what kind of drugs are usually being found in the drugged driving cases? Are you seeing more opioids or meth?
We are, actually. Within the last few years, we've seen a shift. Usually the most common drugs we found were alcohol and marijuana, followed by cocaine and methamphetamine. And within the last few years, we've really seen that trajectory change to we're detecting more opioids. So morphine, which is actually heroin, we're seeing more cases. That's within our top four or five most common drugs in impaired drivers. We also see something called Xanax or Alprazolam. That also is one of our most common drugs that we're seeing. And what's also a little bit disturbing are not only the drugs we're seeing, but the concentrations. They're greater concentrations than we've ever seen before. So people taking more than we've ever seen before, and then in combination with one another. So a lot of what we see not only focuses on that alcohol piece and how many drivers in Wisconsin have alcohol in their system, but then also just that combination of alcohol and other drugs, which is really troubling.
So your toxicologists are actually breaking down a drug cocktail of sorts.
Right.
In their bloodstream.
Right. And for us, the most important piece for us really is we want to be able to provide as much information, not only to law enforcement and the prosecutors, but also to the Department of Health, so they can make determinations of assessment for individuals so we can help them avoid recidivism. Mm-hmm. And so what's unfortunate in our laboratory, given that workload that we keep talking about, we do have sort of testing policies and barriers in place because we can't perform testing on every single sample that we have. So a lot of our testing is dependent on that blood alcohol concentration. If it reaches a certain threshold, we don't pursue that drug testing. And that's a detriment to that person in Wisconsin because we can't help them then to be assessed appropriately if we're only talking about their alcohol use and maybe not whatever drug use is on board as well.
You don't have that complete picture.
Right.
Yeah. Orville from Madison called in to ask, where is the lab located? And then he also asked, do they do forensic ballistics?
Those are great questions. So the lab is sort of spread out because we are as big as we are. We do have a location down on campus in Madison, and then we have a secondary location out on the east side. And then that location is kind of split into two buildings out there where the laboratory piece is out on the east side of Madison. And then we also have our IS or IT group out on the east side as well. So we've gotten really big, which is wonderful because there's a need for great overarching public health testing in Wisconsin. And then that meant we had to spread out a little bit. As far as the ballistics testing, no, we do not. And sometimes I'm happy for that. I really like that my group really focuses just on that forensic toxicology piece because we really have become the experts in forensic toxicology and we really are able to do a lot, especially being part of the UW.
Well, let's look at this growing caseload for a moment. And it's put the hygiene lab under pressure in recent years. Last year, you received about 4,300 more alcohol and drug cases than 4 years prior. That's a 22% increase. So what do you think is causing that?
We know there is a little bit of give and take between our forensic toxicology lab and the crime lab. So for a while, when our laboratory was really having a difficult time with a long time to turn around a drug case, some of those cases we shifted to the crime lab. The unintended consequence of that was then the crime lab had kind of that overburden. So we're trying to find that happy medium between resource between the two labs and then being able to shift some of that workload between the two of us. So, you know, there definitely is a give and take. And like I said, unfortunately, what sort of has to suffer a little bit is we can't do all of the testing we want to do. So we do the testing that is necessary to provide information. In a ideal world, we would test all of those 24,000 cases for everything.
We're looking at the work of the State Hygiene Lab, the struggles with a growing caseload in doing all the OWI blood tests. Amy Miles is Director of Forensic Toxicology at the State Hygiene Lab. How do you think the state should respond to the growing caseload at the Hygiene Lab? Should lawmakers add more workers or perhaps more funding for equipment? Should the lab work with the existing resources? We're at 800-642-1234. You can tweet us at WPR Mornings. So the lab's data, the whole data component, says the number of vehicular death investigations involving alcohol and drug tests has more than doubled since 2014 to nearly 700 cases last year. Are there similar factors driving that increase as you see this uptick in the number of cases?
I think a big piece of the reason why we're seeing that increase just in the laboratory data mm-hmm. also is medical examiners have the option to choose whatever the lab they want for their testing. Oh. So oftentimes they will send their samples to a different state. And because we did a reorganization of our department within the last 5 years and kind of streamlined things a little bit, we've gotten new instrumentation thanks to the Department of Health. We've reduced the amount of time it takes to turn around a case. And so now those cases that were going out of state are now coming back to the lab. So we are slowly but surely getting to that point where we want all of those cases to come to one place so we know all the testing is consistent and the data is consistent. Because then when we report back out to our local and national partners, the data speaks more and tells you more.
Christina from Glenwood City called in to say that her brother-in-law took Ambien and then started driving. What can you tell us about those kinds of cases and what Ambien can do?
So Ambien is also known as Zolpidem, and we actually have somebody at our lab, his name is Bill Johnson, who several years ago did a tremendous job at looking at, he noticed that we were seeing so many of these Ambien cases. And we wanted to know more about them. So Bill took it upon himself to really research that data and look at, are the concentrations we're seeing typical of somebody taking a 10 milligram dose of Ambien, or are the concentrations greater? So he looked at all of the demographics of the population. He looked at the concentrations of the cases we were seeing, the impairment that we saw. So the majority of the cases he found, the concentration in the blood was greater than what we would consider therapeutic. So people were taking more than they should. And then he also found that the tendency to crash is greater, almost 50% greater, when you are under the influence of Ambien. So we know individuals are taking Ambien, whether it's prescribed or not, in greater concentrations than they should, whether that's intentional or not. And then that's when crashes are occurring.
It seems like the lab prioritizes the death investigations over normal OWI tests. The average turnaround time for death investigation evidence hasn't changed all that much in recent years, but the OWI cases have been slower. Is that a correct read of the data?
It is correct. We do most of the medical examiner testing for the state. And we realized roughly 5 years ago we were taking too much time to get that information back to the medical examiners so they could give a death certificate back to the family so they could move on. So we decided to prioritize those cases and get those cases in and out as quickly as we could in a, you know, timely manner for that family. And we found that that's made a big difference. We used to get a lot of phone calls years ago from families that wanted answers and we couldn't give them because we were still working on their cases. So we're still going to continue to streamline that testing. We just, within the next few weeks, we'll be implementing a new instrument that the Department of Health purchased for us that will reduce that turnaround time and expand our scope of testing. So we'll be able to see more of those fentanyl-type drugs that we're seeing in these overdose cases, and then we'll be able to give answers back to families more quickly.
How does the lab decide what to prioritize in terms of testing? How do you do that?
That's a good question. We take feedback. We take feedback from the medical examiners. We take feedback from the prosecutors and the defense community. We work with everyone to just try to prioritize and understand what are the needs, how can we diversify our resources with what we have, and then, you know, just move forward with, again, prioritizing those medical examiner cases And then if we have a law enforcement case that maybe it's somebody that's on their second, third, fourth OWI and they continue to drive, prosecutors will let us know that and we'll try to prioritize that so that we can help them move their system along.
So you look at the individual cases itself in order to make some, you know, decisions on what to do next.
To a certain degree. I mean, there are so many that it's impossible to look at each one. Right. But we definitely take feedback. We work with the public as much as we can. Subjects and individuals that have had their samples drawn will call us and talk to us. And so we try to do the best we can with what we've got, but it's hard to prioritize everybody.
Talking about the growing caseload and new methods for collecting evidence at the State Hygiene Lab, Amy Miles is Director of Forensic Toxicology at the Wisconsin State Laboratory of Hygiene. She stays with us. Are you a police officer or an attorney who's worked with the Hygiene Lab? What do you think people should know about it? Have you noticed any of the lab's tests taking longer? How has it affected your work? Join in at 800-642-1234. Coming up, we'll look at what impact adding employees would have on forensic toxicology testing turnaround time. That's after a news update. Stay with us here on the Ideas Network. We're talking about Wisconsin's Forensic Toxicology Lab here on the Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. And the work of this lab involves to test for alcohol and drugs in allegedly impaired drivers and to help medical examiners and coroners in death investigations. And this lab tested about 24,000 specimens just last year. Caseload continues to grow. You join in as well, 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about the work of forensic toxicology? And what do you want to know about what this work entails, what this lab does? Call in. You can also email ideas at WPR.org. Amy Miles is our guide. She's director of forensic toxicology at the State Hygiene Lab. Amy, in talking about the lab's growing caseload and the slower turnaround on some specimens, how does slower testing affect OWI cases? Could police officers or prosecutors be waiting to move forward with these cases due to specimens needing testing?
Absolutely. And that's something that we've struggled with my entire career. We know that the arrest process happens and then everything sort of just gets put on hold until we can provide the data and the information from the testing. So when you ask me about prioritizing cases, sometimes we'll get a call from a judge or from a prosecutor or a defense attorney to say, hey, I have this trial in 2 weeks. What do you have? What can you tell me? How can you help me? And then sometimes in those cases, if we're not finished with testing yet, we may try to triage some of that remaining testing. And then, you know, some of those drugs that we consider wouldn't be impairing, maybe we don't pursue and we only pursue those drugs that are either illicit or a prescription medication that would be considered impairing. But we absolutely know and take it to great heart that everyone is waiting for us and the crime lab in the same manner. Once we get that sample, the clock really starts for us and we know we have to get that sample out right away. But we're also bound by an accrediting agency, as is the crime laboratory. So we take our testing very seriously and we make sure it's done right. So if that means doing it right is going to take a little bit longer, then that's what it's going to take. Because in the end, you want that product and that data to have integrity.
You talked earlier about some new equipment. How is the lab doing so far this year? With alcohol testing, at least, it seems like the lab is perhaps turning a corner and seeing quicker turnaround times.
We are. And I think that is largely due to we were carrying three vacancies for quite a while. We had a few people leave and we had somebody else transfer to a different department. And we took that opportunity to promote people and to be able to provide those people that have been working in this section for all these years a reward for doing so. Now we've finally filled those three vacancies. And so we're starting to see the benefit of that. And then in addition to those three vacancies, the Department of Health has told us they will provide funding for us to hire more people so we can really focus more and segregate off those medical examiner cases and try to get the turnaround time for those even less.
This is a slight segue, but what does the educational path look like for someone in your work, for a forensic toxicologist?
Well, back in ye olden times, when I first came in, you know, it was a bachelor's degree. Uh-huh. And then, you know, if you could get an advanced degree, if you could find one in forensic toxicology, then you would try to pursue that. Now, what I encourage, I speak at UW-Platteville because they have a forensic investigator program. And we actually hire people out of Platteville that are very talented because they do a really nice job of preparing them for forensic science. I tell them, get in an advanced degree. That really is where you will hone in your forensic toxicology skills. There didn't used to be all of these forensic science programs across the country like there are now, and there are a few that specialize in forensic toxicology, which is great. So when we see those people come in and interview, it is a different level. They've got not only the analytical experience that we like, but then they also have that testimony piece, which is so important. It's very hard to train somebody how to testify or how to just act in a courtroom. So if they can get that training throughout their education, that's even better for us. And then we do encourage, you know, a lot of our folks don't have that the master's degree or the PhD. So we do have at least one person right now that's pursuing a master's here at UW-Madison. And so we do encourage that and try to help them as much as we can to foster that education.
Yeah, what is that like being on the stand? And when you go to court, explain that piece.
It's hard to explain. It definitely, you know you're there because that's part of your job. However, you are there and you are being sort of grilled for who you are and what you do. But I think it's easier for our group because the science we do, the data, the testing is all solid. So if I have to testify about a result, I'm confident in that result. And then beyond that, oftentimes we'll be asked to testify as experts in the effects of alcohol and drugs. So there are several of us that kind of specialize in certain areas and testify as experts.
Let's go to the phones now with Gary joining us from Iron River. Hi, Gary.
Hi, good morning, ladies. Say a couple questions real quick. One, we've heard a lot of sort of general comments, adjectives and adverbs about time and delay. How about putting some numbers to that and giving us an idea of how long it takes to do a test from arrival? And then a little bit about the process. Is most of the manual physical work sort of sample prep and then data entry, and the testing is just popped into a machine and is automated, or how does that all work? Give us better perspective, please.
Sure. And that's actually, it sounds like you're a fellow scientist. You have a lot of the lingo down. You're right. It does take time. So an alcohol test is our most simple test, and everything that we do requires some sort of sample handling first or extraction. So that alcohol test, it takes very little time to get that sample ready for the instrument. The time delay then is for the sample to actually run on the instrument. And that usually happens overnight. And then we can usually get the data reviewed and the reports out within 3 to 5 days after an alcohol test. The drug testing is far more complex. Depending on the number of drugs you find, typically each drug you find, and in some cases we've had people with 9 drugs in their system, each of those drugs takes a different day to sample it and then a different day to run it and so on and review the data. So we're talking, you could have 3 months to 4 months just for a drug report to be completed. Mm-hmm. And again, it just depends on how many drugs are there and the complexity of that testing.
Because for each drug, there's perhaps a different scientific procedure as you figure out the numbers on how much is in the system, or how does that work?
That's exactly right. And the first thing we do with all of the samples is we screen them because we need to know what's in them to figure out how we want to pursue our testing. So there's 2 levels of screening that happen, and those take a few weeks at least. Although with the new instrumentation we have, that will be shrunk down to a week or less. Once we screen them and figure out what's there and how we want to pursue them, because we're accredited, we're bound by accrediting procedures and compliance factors that we must then confirm and be sure that what we're screening is what we're going to report. So then to confirm it and get a number for it takes yet another sample extraction, another run on an instrument, another data review, and so on and so on.
So Attorney General Josh Call is pushing lawmakers to help the state crime lab by funding more workers. Is the hygiene lab also seeking aid from this year's state budget?
We are, in sort of a roundabout way. One of the areas that we feel like we could really excel in is the research piece, because we have so much data and so many samples and just that ability through the university to provide research. So we've actually got in the current budget cycle a request for a toxicology faculty position, which would then work with our laboratory to develop new methods, which would be more efficient and take less time to run, but then also pursue some of those research opportunities and grant opportunities that we see come along that we just can't do right now.
Do you know if Governor Evers or the legislature's Republican leaders support new positions?
I don't know.
Okay.
Some of the whispers that I've heard are that they will support it, and mostly because one of the reasons why we put in this position is the opioid issue. Mm-hmm. And we really want to start exploring and better identifying those opioids that are out there, whether it's in a medical examiner or a driver. So we're hopeful that it will be approved.
Talking with Amy Miles, Director of Forensic Toxicology at the State Hygiene Lab. Your insights, your questions, welcome, 800-642-1234. I want to move on to this new method for detecting drugs in drivers. The Hygiene Lab is studying a new way that would involve the roadside. Can you tell us what's going on there?
Sure. So the Bureau of Transportation Safety, or BOTS, they're housed within the Department of Transportation. In 2016, they wanted to explore roadside oral fluid testing and a handheld device that would tell law enforcement positive or negative for particular drug classes. So things like overarching drugs for cocaine, marijuana, drugs called benzodiazepines. So those are things like Xanax and Valium. So they wanted to explore, are they valid? Are they reliable? And then kind of tangentially to that, we wanted to know, when we cancel drug testing, if a law enforcement officer sends us a sample and they tell us, don't do drug testing if the blood alcohol is over a 0.1, if we cancel that drug testing, are we underreporting the drug impaired driving population? So in 2016, the Dane County Sheriff's Office took on this project where they had these roadside devices and they used them for 3 months. So anybody they arrested for an OWI offense, they went through the entire arrest process. And then after it was over, they asked individuals if they were willing to volunteer for this project. And we were very surprised, but many people were willing. Mm. And so after the 3 month period, there were roughly 100 cases that came through. And then as the laboratory did their testing or our testing, we would compare what was that roadside device result and what was that blood result. And they correlated really well. So we were actually repeating this project with Manitowoc County right now.
We're talking about the Wisconsin State Laboratory of Hygiene, which operates under the UW system. The toxicology section provides the alcohol and drug testing to law enforcement officers for impaired driving cases and medical examiners, coroners for death investigations. Amy Miles stays with us. She heads up the forensic toxicology section. You can be part of this discussion at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about the State Hygiene Lab? What do you want to know about new roadside testing, about the Hygiene Lab's new method for testing for drug drivers? Have you been arrested for drugged driving? Do you have concerns with the new procedure? Join in with your insights, 800-642-1234. Back in a moment on the Ideas Network. We're learning about the State Hygiene Lab and how to address a growing caseload. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent, and Amy Miles is our guide. She's Director of Forensic Toxicology at the State Hygiene Lab, where in addition to forensic toxicology testing, she trains law enforcement and prosecutors on the impact of drugs and alcohol on driving. And her lab takes in more than 20,000 specimens each year for alcohol and drug testing. You can join in, 800-642-1234. Are you a police officer or a lawyer who's worked with a hygiene lab? What do you think people should know about it? You can call in with your insights, your questions. You can tweet us, WPR Mornings. Let's go to Douglas now, who's joining us from Maiden Rock this morning. Hi, Douglas.
Good morning. I was wondering if all this data that's collected is accessed by politicians, and because with the governor endorsing marijuana legalization, I was wondering if the laboratories had endorsed or not endorsed certain things that should be approved by the state government. Thank you.
And Douglas also brings up a question about privacy and this data and these specimens. What do we know there?
Well, to answer the question about do we take a stance or do we endorse or not, the answer is no. Our role as the State Lab of Hygiene really is to educate and inform. And because we have so much data, I feel like we are in a very good position to do that and be unbiased. So whatever information any policymakers or legislators want to know, we're always able to provide. Because we're part of the university, we are subject to open records requests, and we fill hundreds and hundreds of those each year. So anybody that wants the information and wants the data within reason, we're happy to provide, as long as we can also provide context. You know, we don't just provide data and just let it sit. There's always caveats and things we need to provide as further information. But, you know, we certainly are always willing, and I've testified a number of times at the Capitol on certain bills just to give information so they understand, you know, what it is they're voting on, and so that they're clear and they can make good decisions, because that's really what we want.
And in terms of the privacy and these specimens, what happens there?
In terms of privacy, I always think of HIPAA, I guess, mm-hmm. when we think of healthcare, and that does not apply to operating while intoxicated blood specimens. We are not covered under that HIPAA umbrella, nor are those medical examiner cases covered under that either. However, you know, if somebody wanted to know just out of curiosity what somebody's result was, we don't provide that. You must be either the subject or the subject's attorney, you know, have some sort of specific interest in a sample or a case for us to provide information.
Well, let's quickly, because we're running out of time, go back to this roadside testing. You mentioned in Manitowoc County this month, you're rolling out a new study there. What does that look at?
So the Manitowoc project is very similar to the Dane County project, mm-hmm. where Dane County officers use those roadside devices. The extra layer to the Manitowoc one is not only using those devices again to make sure they're, you know, easily usable by law enforcement. We want to make sure they're reliable. We don't want false information coming from those test results. But then they're also collecting a second oral fluid sample that comes to the State Lab of Hygiene, which we will test using forensic toxicology testing. So it's more of an evidential type test. All of this is de-identified. No, you know, if anybody ever asked results of Joe Smith's sample from this project, we have no idea whose is whose, and we can't answer that. Because this really is in the vein of, are there other options that we can be doing other than blood testing at the roadside to collect those samples more quickly?
So if the roadside method looks promising, would you need legislative action?
We would. Right now, there is nothing in the state statute either to allow the use of the roadside oral fluid devices or the collection of oral fluid. So we would need to add at least one or the other, or both, hopefully, to the state statutes.
In the last few seconds we have with you, I'm just curious, you know, what's your struggle? What do you grapple with in your job? You've been at the lab for 20 years.
I think the biggest piece I struggle with is the sheer volume of samples we do. And that's why I feel like a big part of what we do is education and training. So people understand what that means when they do drive impaired, and what that means when you think you are okay to drive, but maybe you're not, and how that could affect everyone else.
Amy, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Amy Miles is the Director of Forensic Toxicology at the Wisconsin State Laboratory of Hygiene. As part of WPR's High Tolerance series on alcohol in Wisconsin, we now turn to a story about regional disparities in addiction treatment. Rich Kramer reports that in rural parts of the state, there are few treatment options, and estimates suggest that more than three quarters of those who need help aren't getting it.
On a crisp February night in the city of Washburn, hundreds of cross-country skiers slide past the finish line of the Book Across the Bay annual ski race. The event draws thousands of people, but a lot of them are there for the party. Inside the beer tent, a local brewer expects to sell 270 gallons of beer. 11 miles down the shore in Ashland, volunteer group Partners in Recovery is hosting an alcohol-free open house at the city's first drop-in center for those recovering from alcohol and drug addiction. Substance abuse counselor and recovering addict Jerry Seitz says many of his clients are chronically addicted to alcohol and drugs, meaning they've lost jobs or become homeless as a result. He says it can be frustrating work because of a lack of long-term residential treatment options in the region.
Sometimes I go home at night, I just feel kind of helpless and hopeless. And I know myself and my colleagues, all of us that work with the alcoholic addict, we try to do the best we can with limited resources.
That's why in 2014, the Lac du Flambeau Band of Lake Superior Chippewa broke ground on an 18-bed residential treatment center called Gakumas Indad. Executive Director Patty Thompson says the tribe spent millions of dollars building a 90-day treatment program for tribal and non-tribal clients they call relatives.
It can be done. This is not a project that anyone or two people or even a dozen people can do. It takes a lot of people to do this.
Counties in far northeastern Wisconsin have the state's highest density of liquor licenses per capita, but there are only two residential treatment programs in the region. For most in rural areas, weekly sessions with substance abuse counselors are the only treatment option. But even if residential facilities are available, getting coverage is difficult, especially for the state's poorest residents. That's because while Medicaid pays for treatment therapy, it doesn't cover room and board. The same goes for some private insurance in Wisconsin. The Ellie Phillips Libertas Treatment Center in Chippewa Falls offers detoxification services, a 30-day residential treatment program, and outpatient counseling. Executive Director Tony Simonson says Medicaid only pays providers 59 cents for every dollar spent on treatment options that are covered. She says that's one reason there aren't more intensive treatment centers in the state.
It doesn't make a lot of money, and typically organizations that provide health care look at health care that can make a lot of money.
In October, the Wisconsin Department of Health Services got federal approval to use Medicaid dollars for short-term residential treatment. But Simonson and county health officials said the old rules still applied this spring. Wisconsin consistently ranks near the top of states in binge drinking and alcohol use among adults, according to federal data. The state also ranks near the bottom in terms of the risk residents associate with drinking.
Alcohol is such a socially acceptable drug that people think, oh, it's just drinking.
That's Michael Malson of Lac du Flambeau. He's struggled with alcohol most of his life. After getting arrested for drunk driving in 2018, he sought help from the Gakumas Indad treatment facility owned by the Lac du Flambeau Band of Lake Superior Chippewa.
It's a drug. It's a sickness that you get from drinking it. And to be spiritually and truly happy, you got to get help from someone who's a professional and who's going to steer you down the right path.
A 2017 report from the Wisconsin Department of Health Services highlighted gaps in the state's treatment options for those addicted to drugs and alcohol. It estimated that 78% of people who need professional help didn't get it. That works out to around 355,000 residents. Rich Kramer, Wisconsin Public Radio.
And you can read more about this story and see the rest of our series, High Tolerance, at WPR.org/alcohol. Just ahead, we look at the role of women in Wisconsin politics as Governor Evers clashes with Republican leaders in the state legislature. Then we hear about a program trying to help pregnant women overcome drug use and addiction. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is The Morning Show. You're listening to the Ideas Network.